This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, October 10th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. U.S. British bombs have killed 76 Afghani residents with no evidence Osama bin Laden is among the dead. And the U.S. has teamed up with the Northern Alliance. Are they any better or any worse than the Taliban?
I don't think that the Northern Alliance will be an improvement over the Taliban. I think it'll just be more of the same. Another bunch of extremist fundamentalists.
We represent a moderate Islamic group.
But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Turkish parliament is now considering sending troops to support military action by the United States in Afghanistan. James Smoot reports from Istanbul.
The Turkish general staff has prepared a preliminary plan to send 800 special forces and intelligence agents to Afghanistan, troops with extensive experience fighting Kurdish guerrillas in southeastern Turkey and northern Iraq. Parliament is expected to vote on the resolution tonight or tomorrow morning. U.S. Ambassador to Turkey Robert Pearson made a formal request for Turkish military assistance today. He also asked that troop limits for the NATO airbase at Incirlik be lifted. Incirlik, the largest NATO facility in Turkey, is going to become a frontline base for U.S. air operations in Afghanistan. Turkey has also dispatched a team of high-ranking military officers and experts in chemical and biological warfare to Washington for consultations. While Parliament is expected to grant the government's request, the vote will not be unanimous. Members of the Islamic opposition parties have expressed reservations about helping the United States attack another Muslim country. For Free Speech Radio News, this is James Smoot in Istanbul.
UN member states fear other countries may be targets of the so-called U.S. war on terrorism. Susan Wood reports from the UN.
The New York Times reports that as bombs began falling on Afghanistan last Sunday, the United States warned the Iraqi government not to undertake any actions the U.S. might consider hostile. The paper says the warning was conveyed by John Negroponte, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. The Times quotes an unnamed U.S. official as saying Iraqi President Saddam Hussein was advised that the U.S. is watching and has capabilities in the region. Negroponte sent a letter to the U.N. Security Council saying the U.S. and British airstrikes are acts of self-defense under the U.N. Charter. Self-defense, said Negroponte, may require further actions against other organizations and states the U.S. accuses of harboring terrorists. At an impromptu news conference Tuesday evening, U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan said that sentence has, in his words, caused some anxiety among U.N. member countries. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
A man in prison for flag burning may leave if he agrees to a judge's condition that he never touches a flag again. Pauline Bartolone reports from the Urbana-Champaign Indy Media Center.
David Stout of Noblesville, Indiana, has been incarcerated for flag desecration and resisting law enforcement since his arrest on September 30th. The Noblesville judge has made the condition that if released from jail, the 49-year-old man may not, quote, touch, handle, possess, or have any physical contact with a U.S. flag. Stout was accused of burning the flag behind his home in one of the 48 states that still have laws against flag desecration. Despite rulings by the U.S. Supreme Court that flag burning is constitutionally protected under the right to free speech, Stout was being held in jail with a $9,000 bond. Hamilton County deputy, the prosecutor against Stout, agrees that a new sensitivity to flag desecrations has been created as a result of the September 11th attacks. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Pauline Bartolone of the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center.
Minnesota state workers still on strike are willing to go to the bargaining table this week. Melissa Mendelson reports from Minneapolis.
Today, Minnesota's largest state strike enters its 10th day. More than 22,000 state workers remain on the picket lines demanding pay increases and better health insurance coverage. Union leaders representing the state's striking workers, the Minnesota Association of Public Employees, and the state of Minnesota will return to the bargaining tables on Thursday. Entering back into negotiations is critical at this point, say strikers, though both union representatives and Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura are adamant about their demands. In an interview on Minnesota Public Radio on Tuesday, Ventura said that the state cannot afford to meet the union's demands without raising taxes. Striking workers contend that plenty of spare cash exists in state agencies. For Free Speech Radio News in Minneapolis, I'm Melissa Mendelson.
Rhode Island state legislators have told the Brown University president to stay out of negotiations where graduate students are trying to unionize. More from Meredith Hemphill in Providence.
The debate that began in May when the Brown Graduate Employee Organization petitioned on whether the UAW should be the sole bargainers for student assistance became more serious this week when Congressman Patrick Kennedy and James Langvin asked the university to drop its opposition to the union and turn neutral. However, Ruth Simmons, the university's president, made it clear that she had no intention of backing down. The desire for unionization is not shared by all of Brown graduate students either. Some believe that it would be better to take these issues to the Graduate Student Council, while others believe that they will not support the issue because it only allows current assistants to vote.
That was Free Speech Radio News correspondent Meredith Hemphill, and I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
At least 76 people have been killed and more than 100 have been wounded in 4 days of U.S.-British airstrikes in Afghanistan. This, according to Afghanistan's state-run AIP news agency. AIP reported 25 of those killed were residents of the capital city, Kabul, and 28 were residents of the southern city of Kandahar. Reba Nawa has more from Islamabad.
There are bombs being dropped in Kabul. I don't know the details specifically. And in Kandahar, in the capital, the heartland of the Taliban, about four or five bombs dropped just about half an hour ago near the airport. I spoke to a resident who was about 30 kilometers from the airport, and he said he could not see anything. But he was in an office, and the office was shaking. The windows and the walls were all shaking. As he described what was going on, his voice was shaking. He could only talk to me through a satellite phone, and he wasn't able to articulate well. I think he was very scared. He hung up soon after that, saying that he needed to find a place to hide, and there was nowhere to hide. But these air raids are taking place every night about this time. There were also raids on Kandahar this morning about 11 o'clock. And the same source told me that they've nearly destroyed the airport. There's not much of it left. The people are scared. He didn't know about any civilian casualties, although there are. The Taliban have been saying there have been tens of civilian deaths, but nobody can really assess that right now. I have family in Herat, which is in the western side near Iran. I have been trying to get a hold of them, again, through a satellite phone with no luck. It's very difficult to assess the damage that is going on in Afghanistan other than hearsay from whoever we can get a hold of, because reporters are not allowed inside those Taliban-controlled areas.
Reba Nawa from Islamabad. The world's largest Islamic body expressed concern at the prospect of civilian casualties today, but steered clear of condemning U.S. strikes against the country. Ministers also called on the United States to allow the United Nations to play a greater role in any international anti-terrorism campaign. That's a move spurned by President Bush. More from Maya Sablini in Qatar.
The organization of the Islamic Conference meeting ended with the communique seen here in Doha as mild and moderate. As expected, the participants strongly condemned terror attacks against the U.S., which they qualified as brutal. The member states of the OIC also expressed their condolences and sympathy to the people, the government of the United States, and the families of the victims. Fearful of confusion between Islam and terrorism, the OIC stressed that acts of terror are contrary to all three main religions. Member states also expressed their readiness to cooperate in the combat against terrorism as long as this combat is conducted under the auspices of the United Nations. So far, the UN has been relegated to the sideline. But while condemning terrorism, the OIC final communique makes a clear distinction between acts of terror and acts of resistance. The text speaks of rights to self-determination, self-defense, resistance against Israeli and foreign occupation, all of which, the document says, are legitimate rights. The Palestinian question a topic on which a consensus can easily be found among Islamic states, was a very central one during this extraordinary meeting. With no surprise, the OIC called for a solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict according to UN resolutions. It also welcomed the President Bush declaration about the right of the Palestinians to establish their own state. The only real stance taken by the OIC is its rejection of any Islamic or Arab state being targeted under the pretext of fighting terrorism. But this is expressed in a very timid way in a short sentence slipped into the text. The country hinted at is mainly Iraq. Several high-level U.S. officials have mentioned Iraq as a potential target. The most striking is that neither bin Laden nor the strikes on Afghanistan are mentioned in the final communique. It solely expresses its concern over the death of innocent civilians in Afghanistan. Thus, the OIC final communique is broadly interpreted here among diplomats and Arab journalists as taking a pro-American stance. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Maya Sidini in Qatar.
U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has all but said U.S. ground troops will be involved in the next phase of military assault against the Taliban in Afghanistan. The Pentagon just hasn't announced yet when that assault will begin. It's widely known, however, that prominent in that ground strategy is a dubious group of Afghan rebels known as the Northern Alliance. The Northern Alliance, a.k.a. the United Front, has been fighting the Taliban for control of Afghanistan for 5 years. Now its alliance with the U.S. Coalition Against Terrorism and its military might all but secures the alliance the victory that's eluded it since the mid-1990s. But critics say ushering what they call a motley coalition like the alliance into power would be simply trading one terrorist for another. Asad Isni is a Pakistani professor who lives in Toronto, Canada.
I don't think that the Northern Alliance will be an improvement over the Taliban. I think it'll just be more of the same, another bunch of extremist fundamentalists. I can guarantee you that as soon as anyone puts them in power, anyone is silly enough to put them in power, they'll be at each other's throats again. Once again, they'll destroy the country as they did from 89 to 96. I don't have any hope in these people whatsoever. There is some indication that this group, Northern Alliance, also includes communist generals from the communist era. Now, I don't know if you can think of a more unstable coalition than that. Bunch of extremist fundamentalists and communist generals. Okay. So what do you think will happen when these people are let loose on each other?
Indeed, the U.S. State Department has reported in the past that in areas of Afghanistan controlled by the Northern Alliance, drugs flow freely throughout the state. At the same time, the alliance fighters are familiar with the difficult mountainous terrain of Afghanistan. They speak the local dialect, and they control the airbase in northern Kabul, all factors that make them a godsend to the Bush administration's stated desire to get Osama bin Laden dead or alive. So while the U.S. coalition might be an answer to the alliance's prayer, it can't be missed that the match seems almost heaven-made. When asked by reporters on Monday whether the alliance was appreciably better than the Taliban, Secretary Rumsfeld responded, "Our particular interest is clear. It's to root out terrorism. It's up to the Afghani people to sort out what happens thereafter." Raven Fahardy is the Northern Alliance representative to the United Nations. He denies accusations that the alliance is comprised of communists, anti-communists, and Muslim extremists.
No, there are some, maybe a few, who are repentant communists. I mean, they are no more communists. We represent a moderate Islamic group and also supporting the rights of women to education, and also we are believing in democracy, and we intend to have in Afghanistan to establish a multi-ethnic, broad-based government which will be busy in the reconstruction of the country, also in the strengthening of a democratic regime.
Whatever the label, alliance leaders have been unmistakably brutal. General Rashid Dostum is notorious for tying political foes to tanks headed in opposite directions. Human Rights Watch researcher Vikram Parekh.
I mean, what may be of perhaps greater concern in a larger sense was the behavior of some of these forces in Kabul. I mean, their forces were also implicated in looting, rapes, and indiscriminate shelling of civilian populated areas. So, I mean, quite apart from their treatment of prisoners, they have a very sketchy past when it comes to treatment of civilians.
You seem to be holding back a bit. How does Human Rights Watch characterize the Northern Alliance in on its scale of 1 to 10 in terms of the human rights abuses that an organization like this has committed?
Well, this the essential problem is, and I think this applies to the Taliban as well as the United Front or Northern Alliance, is that you can't make a broad generalization. Both of these factions are composed of people who have joined for a variety of reasons and whose conduct towards civilians in areas under their control varies quite considerably. Our view of the Northern Alliance is that there are individuals within it, particular commanders or particular parties, who should not be supported or cooperated with militarily or otherwise by the United States and its allies. On the other hand, there are people who could, because either they have a certain measure of local legitimacy or because they have a proven record of decent administrative abilities, be potential partners. Our point is that the United States and its allies need to be selective.
Tariq says while the Taliban and the alliance both have bad human rights records, they're bad in different ways. But he warns that if the U.S. is indiscriminate in who they bring on board, it will undermine any attempts at holding leaders accountable for war crimes in other parts of international law and could allow abusive commanders to consolidate authority once again. The United States today said it would be taking a very close look at the issue of declaring the Pakistan-based militant outfit Jaish-e-Mohammed a terrorist organization. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher told reporters in Washington the U.S. has expressed its strong condemnation of the attack on the Kashmir Assembly by the organization and said, "We have been concerned about the violent activities of this group and looking at any information the government of India gives." Secretary of State Colin Powell sets out tomorrow for South Asia with meetings scheduled in both India and Pakistan. Soothing tensions in Kashmir is expected to be key to the discussions. From Kashmir, Sputnik Colombi reports.
India has been baying for blood since October the 1st, when the Pakistan-based Jaish-e-Mohammed claimed responsibility for the suicide attack on the Kashmir State Assembly, which left over 40 dead. Washington's dithering so far over whether to include the group in its list of foreign terrorist groups has drawn severe criticism here, with India threatening to deal with the Jaish and other Pakistani-based groups on its own. Washington cannot afford the inevitable flare-up between Islamabad and New Delhi, which would result at this juncture. Hence, the U.S. reassurances that the group is already on the terrorism list, and Secretary of State Colin Powell's expected visit to India and Pakistan next week. It also explains Pakistan's condemnation of the suicide attack and President Musharraf's apparent willingness to look into Indian allegations of cross-border terrorism. Bashir Manzar, editor of Kashmir Images.
At this juncture, the entire global opinion is going against terrorism and what happened in Srinagar, that Jammu and Kashmir Assembly blast, and one of the Pakistani groups, Jaish-e-Mohammed, owning that responsibility. Musharraf found himself in a tight spot at this juncture. I mean, he may be playing his game, he may be trying to buy some time, but that this time he's really in a tight spot and he cannot bluntly say, no, I'm not going to discuss Jaish-e-Mohammed or these kind of groups.
This new language, coming on the heels of Pakistan effectively ditching the Taliban, has sent shivers up the backs of separatist groups in Kashmir. But they won't and can't admit it publicly. This reaction from Bashir Ahmad Bhatt, General Secretary of the Jammu and Kashmir Liberation Front, part of the Hurriyat umbrella organization of Kashmiri separatist groups.
He has said that I will see I will inquire, I will investigate whether there is any terrorism in Kashmir or not. They have not said that we will crack down on the freedom fighters of Kashmir. Pakistan cannot withdraw the support of the freedom fighters of Kashmir. That is not possible for the President of Pakistan.
There is no doubt, however, that the Kashmir issue is a different ballgame as far as Pakistan is concerned. Musharraf is on a very sticky wicket, says Bashir Manzar of Kashmir Images.
He has already annoyed Taliban and all four Taliban Islamist groups, and he can't. This time the only, the escape route is that is Kashmir. He has to talk very tough on Kashmir. That is the only point that may give him some acceptability within those hardliners. I think he's really in a difficult situation. How come he can solve this, I don't know, but he cannot afford to openly condemn militant groups who are operating in Kashmir. It will be very difficult for him.
Meanwhile, Musharraf continues to try and steer through the murky waters of the post-September 11th world order and has invited Indian Foreign Minister Jaswant Singh to visit Islamabad to restart peace talks. India's response is a yes, but. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Chokila Iyer.
I believe that the situation continues to hold at the present time. As far as Pakistan sponsoring cross-border terrorism or supporting terrorism in Jammu and Kashmir, that is a minimum as far as we're concerned. That has to be dealt with in a satisfactory manner at the present time.
So while Musharraf continues to walk on his own tightrope, India shows no sign of reviewing its Kashmir policy. Neither do Kashmiri separatist groups. The killing of three civilians in cold blood by Indian security forces 2 days ago only reinforces that conviction. Bashir Ahmad Bhatt of the Jammu and Kashmir Liberation Front.
But so far as Kashmir is concerned, there is no terrorism on the side of freedom fighters. If there is any terrorism, that is the state terrorism. There is no other terrorism. There is a freedom fight. We are fighting for our freedom from the last 53 years.
The reality, however, is that a withdrawal of Pakistani support would be close to a death blow for Kashmiri separatism. Bashir Manzar again.
They will become really very weak. Means this time we have some four or five groups active here, and only one is which you call Kashmiri group. If you see the strength of militants, that is Hezbollah, Mujahideen, other groups are all based in Pakistan. And once Pakistan draws support, or Pakistan decides to close down these groups, the militant movement will be a big jolt to the militant movement in Kashmir.
Putli Kilambi in Srinagar for Free Speech Radio News.
The famed Arab poet A.L. Tabawi wrote, "O lost paradise, you were never too small for us. But now vast countries are indeed too small. Torn asunder your people, wandering under every star."
Death Row journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal.
When the World Conference Against Racism was occurring in Durban, South Africa recently, the Western corporate media did its damnedest to scuttle, to downplay, and to dismiss the conference. It was, we were told by a host of conservative talking heads, nothing but a bunch of gas bags, a talk fest, a gathering of believers in victimology and the like. The global media projected the groundbreaking gathering as an ominous meeting of anti-Semitism, conveniently forgetting, of course, that Arabs are Semites too. The unspoken yet unmistakable message was that the only real racism in the world was to be found in criticism of Israel on the Palestinian issue, and that blacks, browns, reds, and yellows had no serious beef. The U.S. reaction of hostility to the conference could not be more pronounced. The third UN World Conference Against Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance, its formal name, had scarcely concluded its historic session when events arose that made it urgently relevant. The suicide slamming of three American jetliners into U.S. buildings in New York City and Washington, D.C., has opened up a rushing artery of anti-Arab and anti-Islamic hatred lurking in the American soul. Black and white voices from all parts of the nation blare from radio and TV. They need to take all of them Arabs and send them back where they came from. Hey, they need to make sure every Arab in this country have a special ID card from the INS. They need to blow them damn Arabs back to the blasted Stone Age. I say wipe them all off the map, including that guy, what's his name, that Saddam Hussein. Them Muslims, they ain't really a full of hate. Now, if you've listened to the radio or TV, I'm certain you've heard the anguished, fearful, hate-drenched voices of your fellow Americans. Muslims and dark-skinned Southeast Asians have been threatened, intimidated, assaulted, and killed by Americans reacting to the World Trade Center bombings. For the acts of what may be the few, the majority are suffering. Islamic places of worship have been attacked and desecrated across America as fear is transmuted to hate. Given this flood of threats, violence, and death poised against Arab Americans and those mistaken for Arab Americans, did the U.S. government do the right thing when they spat on the WCAR? In this ugly climate of racial and ethnic hatred, couldn't positive American presence in Durban have mitigated this xenophobia? The U.S. government, which represents a deeply racist, negrophobic nation, sought to spurn the African-American reparations movement by interposing righteous anger by Arabs and Palestinians at Israel as a red herring. The World Trade Center bombings and the resultant racism and xenophobic attacks against Arab Americans proves the danger of a nation ducking difficult questions, for the problems will be raised another way. If the right-wing Bush administration had attended the Durban conference in good faith, then the forces of hatred, racism, and xenophobia would have been diminished instead of emboldened. The words of government officials in response to this xenophobia, which means fear of others, would have had more weight had they done the right thing in Durban. From Death Row, for Free Speech Radio, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. More than 40 reporters in 14 states and 4 continents are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. They need your support. For more information, check out our website at www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Or call 1-510-287-5551. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz. Headlines editor, Randy Zimmerman. Technical producer, Jay Patch Seekins. Technical assistant, Matt Martin. We had web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. This newscast was produced at WMNF Radio in Tampa and the Independent Media Center in New York. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Please tune in again tomorrow for another edition of Free Speech Radio News.